I say inflation, and you think what? No, seriously. What do you think? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. 13 July, Tuesday. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It has been, by now, the better part of a day, maybe more, depending on when you get up in the morning. So I'm going to figure you have heard the big economic headline of the day already. Inflation last month running at a 13-year high, the consumer price index up 5.4% from the same time a year ago. And I am going to assume also that you have heard me talking about base effects and what Jay Powell has to say about inflation for a good, solid couple of months already. So our inflation lead today is you and a survey from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York that shows consumer expectations for inflation over the next year have reached a new high. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab gets us going by looking at why and why that matters.
Consumers are actually not very good at making accurate predictions about inflation, not about the cost of housing or a loaf of bread. But that is not the point of surveying consumer expectations. Olivier Armentier is an economist at the New York Fed.
We want to know if their expectation changing and if as a result of this change in expectation, their behavior is going to change.
Behavior change could mean bigger financial leaps, like taking out a loan for a house, or smaller ones, like buying a TV now because you think the price will go up soon.
This is going to increase demand today. And, you know, as demand increases for goods and services, then prices are also going to increase. So this is a self-fulfilling prophecy.
When people anticipate inflation, they actually cause it, and it just snowballs from there. Carola Binder is an economist at Haverford College.
So once you start noticing certain prices increasing, then, yeah, it makes sense that you would pay more attention to other price changes.
And it's hard to ignore what's right in front of you. Most people drive by gas station fuel signs every day, where prices have been steadily rising. There are also niche versions of this. Binder's is baby strollers. Her double stroller just broke, and she's waiting for a warranty replacement. In the meantime, she's reminded of how much they cost every time she takes her four kids out without one.
Whatever we do in our world, in our reality, in a sense, places us in having certain perceptions about prices.
Francesco DiCunto is a professor of finance at Boston College, and he says when perception feeds reality, reality doubles down. Higher prices make people ask for higher wages.
Then, of course, producers and they are forced at some point to increase wages that potentially will increase prices even more.
So while we look to the Fed and economists for answers, DiCunto says they're looking to us for answers, too. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders did not love that inflation report. They didn't hate it all that much, but they definitely didn't love it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Sometime in the next couple of days, child tax credit payments are going to start rolling out of the Treasury Department. Eligible families can get up to $300 a month, money that will go to some immediate needs in a lot of households, food and clothes, most likely. But eventually, the money could go toward more than just the next grocery store run. Marketplace's Caroline Champlin has that one.
This summer, Alyssa Schmier with the advocacy group Moms Rising will be adding a new dependent to the family.
Very, like, nerdy tax way of saying I'm having a baby.
And it means Schmier will be eligible for the child tax credit. She's already thinking of putting it towards child care.
But then you have diapers and additional doctor's visits and, you know, onesies to buy.
Schmier says some mothers she surveyed are considering a college fund. Other families have a different plan.
They're using their child tax credit to either repair an existing vehicle, to upgrade and get a second vehicle, and that allows now a two-income household to actually have two incomes. And that's a long-term investment.
Mobility can lead to other changes that matter, says Hillary Hoynes, a UC Berkeley economist.
You know, get your child to school, get them to their well checkups, small actions that aggregate up to the potential for long-term effects.
The best historic example of that is nutrition assistance, Hoyne says. Her research has found that better diets for young kids help them succeed in school and lead to increased earnings in adulthood. But this new tax credit goes beyond food.
It's going to go to what the family thinks is the best use of the money.
Another group doing outreach about the tax credit is United Way of Santa Cruz, California. CEO Keisha Browder says most parents she talks to are still getting their heads around the credit in the first place.
To see the eyes of shock, like, whoa, this is happening in our community.
Browder says she wants to help families learn to save, especially those receiving stable income for the first time. I'm Caroline Champlin for Marketplace.
David Brancaccio's got the rest of the week off, wrapping up a vacation. Sabri Benishour and the team, every single morning on the Marketplace Morning Report. Check them out. The news menu for tomorrow and Thursday includes back-to-back trips to Capitol Hill for Fed Chair Jay Powell. His twice annual report to the Congress, technically it's called the Monetary Policy Report to the Congress as mandated by the Humphrey-Hawkins Full Employment Act of 1978, if you're curious. A useful shorter title might be the Here's What the Fed's Thinking About the Economy report. There will, of course, be various and sundry questions from lawmakers. One thing that is definitely going to come up, though, is the Fed's bond buying program and when the Fed might start slowing things down. Bond buying wasn't something the Fed normally did until the financial crisis in 2008 and also now.
In a bad time, such as in the COVID crisis, you know, the Fed did a lot of things to, you know, improve the liquidity conditions in the economies.
That's Yiming Ma. She's an assistant professor of finance at Columbia Business School. And liquidity is what makes it possible for companies to do business, for them to get their hands on cash, to invest in new projects, to borrow, basically, so that they can grow. The Fed, to improve those liquidity conditions, is buying $80 billion worth of treasury bonds and $40 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities every single month. That is a lot of liquidity and a lot of cash.
You know, I think we're very much used to the Fed now buying bonds from the market. I think the key is just to think about how can we get back to where we were without shocking the market.
Get back to where we were, that is to say, without all that liquidity. So we thought perhaps an analogy might help.
So think of, you know, if there's like a lake.
All right. Picturing a lake. Go ahead.
There have to be boats on the lake that have to be able to get around, right? And so if the water level is too low, then, you know, it just does not function smoothly for boats to go from one side to the other.
The boats, companies, need liquidity to do business and keep on moving, to torture the metaphor just a little bit. So in the middle of a pandemic,
the Fed is basically adding some water in that lake to keep the liquidity or to keep the water from completely drying out.
The water here is those billions and billions in bonds and securities the Fed has been buying for going on a year and a half now.
But now if suddenly the Fed is drawing support, you know, that might scare everyone, right? Because they don't know if, you know, suddenly the adding of the water stops, if there's still going to be enough water in the system. And so no one goes out on the boats and no one trusts the lake anymore.
And that right there is the whole smash. It's why Jay Powell has said again and again and again that the Fed is going to be really, really clear and really, really gradual when it starts to taper down its purchases of those bonds.
Because sometimes people's reaction, the fear in the market, is also something that can make the system sort of stop working.
You might have heard the phrase taper tantrum. That potential market reaction is what that's about. Right now, with the economy growing, consumer confidence at a 16-month high, it looks like there's enough liquidity in the system. But there are still 7 million fewer jobs than in the before times. There is the Delta variant, and who knows what else, just around the financial corner. Thanks again to Professor Ma at Columbia for that analogy with us. Coming up.
A $1 change in a $100 stock is only 1%.
I know. We usually promise no math, but sometimes you just gotta. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials, down 107 points today, 0.3%, 34,888. The NASDAQ down 55, 0.3%, 14,677. S&P 500 dropped 15 points, again, 0.3%, finished at 4,369. Think about this for just 1 second, though. The S&P 500 is now up 100% from its low of March 2020. More than 100%, actually. Think about that for a minute. Boeing descended 4.2%. Today, the plane maker is cutting production of its 787 Dreamliners after a new flaw was found on some of those jets. Rival European plane maker Airbus also down about 0.8%. Quarterly results from some big banks today. Goldman Sachs slipped 1.1%. JPMorgan Chase gave back 1.4% today. PepsiCo bubbled up 2.3% on stronger than expected quarterly revenue. Europe, Britain's FTSE, France CAC 40, Germany's DAX, all basically unchanged. Back here, bond prices, they were down. Yield on the 10-year T-note up to 1.42%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, so let's do energy here for a minute, about which two things. Number one, crude oil closed up about 1.5% today, over $75 a barrel. So that, but also a new report from the Clean Energy Futures Project, which is a collaboration between Harvard and Syracuse and Georgia Tech, which says a transition to 80% clean electricity in this economy by the end of the decade would cost $342 billion. 80% clean, $342 billion, end of the decade. That's a lot, but the net economic benefit, the report says, would come to something like $1.4 trillion. Seems like a no-brainer to get going on that transition like now, right? Marketplace's Andy Euler is on the yeah desk today.
With drought and wildfires in the west, tropical storms and floods in the northeast, people have never been more aware of the need for action on climate change. Even so, says Kathy Fallon Lambert at Harvard, a lead author of the study, many Americans feel the problem is just too big for individual action to make much difference.
And in some ways, that's true. A problem of this scale is exactly the kind of problem that government action is meant to address.
The study looked specifically at the costs and benefits of decarbonizing the U.S. electricity sector. Charles Driscoll is a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Syracuse University and another lead author of the study.
If you're talking about decarbonizing the electricity sector, you're talking about eliminating the dominant source of air pollution in this country.
Which he says would lead to less asthma, fewer heart attacks, and some other health benefits. And Jason Bordoff, co-founding dean of the Climate School at Columbia University, says from a practical standpoint, there's another good reason to start with electricity.
Some things are harder to decarbonize, like steel and cement and airplanes, but we know how to decarbonize most, if not all, of electricity.
He says for a long time, people talked about climate change as something in the distant future that affected places far from home, like the Arctic. Things like the recent heat wave in the Pacific Northwest have helped change the conversation.
It's no longer a question of whether this is a problem, but let's start talking about what we do about it. There may be disagreement ideologically on that and how much you have private market solutions versus government regulation or something else, but let's acknowledge we have a real problem.
And to solve it, he says the government must incentivize industries to act swiftly in a move away from carbon. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Sometimes in this economy, the pressures to go to college right out of high school can get pretty intense. Pressure from society, maybe, or your family to follow the script, just to go along with expectations, to be, I don't know, successful. That's what gets you there, right? But what if that script just doesn't work for you? From our podcast, This is Uncomfortable, Rima Krace has this story of one listener overwhelmed by all the pressures, but who tries her best to not go off script.
Back in the late 90s, when Anna Sassada was a teenager, there was no moment she dreaded more than when report cards came out.
The teachers would just like tell my parents like, oh, she's failing because she's not studying and not doing the homework. So I think a lot of times they would be shocked because they'd be like, wait, what?
Education was a big deal in her family. Her mom has a PhD, her dad a master's degree. And Anna knew how hard her dad worked to get that advanced degree. He'd grown up as a migrant farm worker from Mexico.
You know, I did not want to disappoint him. It's like, I kind of felt like I can't be this person that's like dragging my family down.
After graduating, she enrolled in a community college in San Francisco. When it was time to pick a major, she'd convinced herself she wasn't any good at math or science. So she just referred back to her parents' life.
And I thought that I was supposed to be like my parents, like my parent, you know, my mom had a degree in sociology. Mm-hmm. My dad, I think, had a degree in political science. That was like my template.
But right away, she was struggling in her classes. She'd been diagnosed with depression, which made it hard to concentrate. And she found herself in this vicious cycle. Every semester, she'd enroll in classes, do poorly, and then withdraw. And her parents were the ones paying for tuition.
It was a bit of a financial strain. It would be like you're building up this debt to my parents.
4 years into community college, as her friends started graduating with their bachelors, Anna still hadn't even finished her core classes.
I guess I just kind of started to tell myself, like, I'm just a person who's just, like, never going to get it together.
About a third of adults in this country have a bachelor's degree, and about 40% of them graduate in 4 years. Anna had come to terms with not being able to finish in that time frame. She withdrew and got a job waitressing.
This was a temporary solution until I was able to go back to school. There really wasn't a world that existed where I wouldn't just have a college degree.
After a couple years of waitressing, Anna thought, okay, now I am serious. Now I'm going to go back to school. And this time she was going to take out student loans. But before she knew it, it was the same cycle all over again. Sign up, get overwhelmed, withdraw. This went on for years. How much in student loans did you take out over the course of your 20s?
Close to 20,000.
Anna felt like she'd reached her breaking point. She'd tell herself, clearly, I'm not working hard enough. And if I'm not working hard enough, then that must mean I'm not grateful for the sacrifices my dad made.
And if I'm not grateful, then am I showing him that I love him enough? It does sometimes feel like pressure. Like, I just don't want them to worry.
Then one day, Anna had a conversation that really stuck with her. She was hanging out with her friend's mom, who turned to her and asked, why haven't you finished school? Anna insisted she was going to go back for political science or sociology, like her parents.
She was just like, that doesn't seem like it's working for you.
Her friend's mom was like, why don't you consider a career in STEM? You know, science, technology, engineering, and math. Subjects that Anna had long convinced herself she wasn't any good at.
Like, why have you told yourself that? Like, have you really asked yourself why you think that?
Anna gave it a shot. She enrolled in chemistry and biology classes. At the time, she was 30 years old, and things just clicked. She eventually joined a campus club for people of color pursuing STEM careers. And that's where she first learned about coding.
And I was like, I feel good at this. Like, I feel like this is doable. Like, mm-hmm. This is something that I can kind of like thrive in.
Learning to code made Anna reevaluate everything that came before this. Like, why did she think she had to go to college right out of high school?
I just regret feeling like I had to keep struggling to try and do something that wasn't working for me at the time. Because for a very long time, I carried around this label that I was like, you dropped out, you're a failure, you know?
Eventually, Anna became a software engineer. And to celebrate, her dad threw her a party.
He was like on cloud nine. He was doing this really embarrassing thing. He would tell people like what my salary, he's like, yeah, she got this job and she's making this much. And I was like, dad, stop.
Anna's learned that no path, prescribed or improvised, is a sure one. So sometimes it is okay, or maybe even better, to go off script. I'm Rima Khreis for Marketplace.
To hear more of Anna's story and a conversation with her dad, follow This Is Uncomfortable on the platform of your choice. We're going to going to do a little mashup now. The Numbers meets our series, I've Always Wondered. Your questions, our answers about this economy and all of its curiosities. Ken Wonder from Bloomington, Indiana, sent us this. What, he wants to know, constitutes a point on the Dow, the S&P, and the NASDAQ? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is on answer duty today.
Whatever they are, these points matter. You can tell from how much excitement they generate when they move a lot, especially downward. As, for instance, WPIX-TV in New York reported on October 19th, 1987.
Good evening. Today is Black Monday, the day the Dow dropped more than 500 points.
So let's start with the Dow. It's the oldest index, and it's calculated differently than the others. Think yourself back to 1884. Men of means are wearing silk top hats and speculating in railroad stocks. And these three investor journalist types,
Charles Dow and his partners Edward Jones and Charles Bergstresser, were putting out a two-page bulletin that they would circulate in the firms in Wall Street.
Thomas Stapleford is an economic historian at Notre Dame.
And so in 1884, they started calculating an average of the prices of 12 stocks, and 10 of those stocks were railroad stocks.
In 1896, they started publishing a new stock average in the financial newspaper they created, the Wall Street Journal, based on 12 big industrial companies. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was literally that, the average cost of a share in those companies. It started out around $30, and a point was a dollar. But in subsequent decades, that $1.1 equivalency went away. The average was adjusted for things like stock splits and mergers. Some companies were dropped and others were added, bringing the total to 30 companies. The Dow's biggest problem today, says Stapleford, is that it's weighted by the prices of shares, and those vary a lot.
So you think about like a $1 change in a $10 stock is 10%. That's a big deal. A $1 change in a $100 stock is only 1%, and that's a much smaller issue. But that $1 change in the $10 stock has the same effect on the movement of the overall Dow Jones as the $1 change in the $100 stock.
By contrast, the S&P 500 and NASDAQ composite, developed decades later, include far more companies and weight them according to their market capitalization. In other words, the cost of a share multiplied by how many shares have been issued. And so, says Santa Clara University finance professor Meyer Statman,
a 1% change in the price of Apple has greater effect on the index than, say, Macy's, which is among the smallest.
One thing nearly everyone agrees on, ignore the point change. It's the percentage change that matters. NYU Emeritus Finance Professor Richard Silla explains.
If you had a 100-point move in the Dow index, that's 0.3%. NASDAQ, that's 0.7%. In the S&P index, that's 2.3%.
Some investment advisors think we should pay less attention to the daily fluctuations in the indexes and focus on the long term. But Notre Dame's Thomas Stapleford says our collective obsession with the Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ numbers isn't all that surprising.
Right. I mean, this is different than unemployment, the consumer price index, or GDP, which are, you know, at best monthly measures. Here you can get a daily update, kind of feeling the pulse of what seems to be going on in the economy.
Except, as we say early and often, the stock market is not the economy. It's just a part of the economy. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which I am going to date myself, but honestly, what the heck? Those of you of a certain age will remember, and perhaps not fondly, New Coke, the soda company's misguided reformulation of its flagship beverage, lo these many years ago. Now, today comes news. Coke Zero's recipe is up for what the company is calling a refresh. I am just going to say, don't. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context before we part, getting us back in a way to where we started, inflation and what it might portend. Remember all the hullabaloo about lumber prices a couple of months ago? Record-setting spikes on high demand and low supply? Yeah, never mind. As of this week, lumber has given back all of its price gains of the year. It's flat in 2021. And that sound you hear is Jay Powell putting a checkmark in the transitory column. Because you know he keeps a little spreadsheet, right? Our digital and on-demand team includes Ufukme Madolu, Olga Oxman, Erica Phillips, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Star Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. Powell's actually probably got somebody who does the spreadsheet for him. I don't know. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.